Good morning. You're listening to WJUL Lowell, Thinking Out Loud, the Environmental Corner. My name's Tony DeSilva, and my co-host, Julie Villarreal, from the Center of Family, Work, and Community. Today's guest is an independent filmmaker from Newmarket, New Hampshire. I want to welcome Tom Jackson. Tom, thanks for coming on the show.
Good morning. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, and the documentary is Greetings from Missile Street.
That's right. It's a 40-minute documentary that focuses on the effects of sanctions and no-fly zones in Iraq. And, of course, as many of your listeners probably know, the effects of those sanctions has been really concentrated on the civilian population, most of all on small children.
Great.
Yes, Tom, let's talk about the children a little, because when I watched this video the other night, I was really, being a parent, it really hit home with me.
Right.
So let's talk about, you know, why the children are affected so much and what kind of diseases they are getting from this and why they are dying from these environmental problems.
Right. Well, basically, to really fully understand what's happened, you have to go back to the Gulf War. During the Gulf War, Allied forces bombed the infrastructure in Iraq, and one of the focuses of that bombing was the water treatment infrastructure. So the result has been, once the war was over, you know, the whole system and the sanitary systems as well were largely destroyed. Then the sanctions are put on, and by way of the sanctions, materials to rebuild water treatment plants, items like chlorine or other things to treat the water, have been blocked out, at least to the extent where, to this day, most of the water systems in Iraq have not been rebuilt. The water treatment plants have not been rebuilt, and the water is just very bad, has all kinds of bad elements in it. So particularly with children, small children have less developed immune systems. So when they drink the water, when they have to drink it, unfortunately, sometimes, they're affected the most by it. And as a result, then you get to phase two of what has been killing so many children in Iraq. Another thing that the sanctions have kept out of the country is the ability for hospitals to really effectively treat these diseases that arise from the bad water. I've been to a number of the hospitals in Iraq, and it's just shocking how stark they are. I mean, there's beds, there's horrible conditions, but there's virtually no machinery. I've seen a partial list of the products that have been blocked from going into Iraq by the United States through their vote on the Security Council, and it has included things like serums and other medications and medical machinery. So the hospital system is as devastated as the water system is, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's the sort of 1-2 punch where you've got bad water, children drink it, then they're taken to the hospital, but there's virtually nothing that these doctors can do for them. They said to us time and time again when we were visiting these hospitals, basically we're like psychologists. We're trying to give these people, the children and their families, a little bit of hope as their children are dying, because there's nothing that we can do for them physically. So the waterborne diseases are all kinds of different things, many of which were eradicated in Iraq prior to sanctions, such as malaria. But the most common killer has been gastroenteritis.
Right.
Simple condition that we can take care of here in the United States by, going to the drugstore for something. Mm-hmm. And yet there, it's the number one killer of children ages 5 and under.
That is so sad. And it was quite poignant in that part of the movie where you were talking to that doctor, and he had to make a decision about the pregnant mother or the child. Who
right.
did he help? He only had one blood bag, and he could only help.
That's one, another situation that has come about because of the way the whole sanctions system works in terms of getting humanitarian products into the country. Is there's a lot of confusion about that with a lot of people here in the United States, and that's because of mainstream media and the government really distorting how the whole system works. Basically, what happens is Iraq is allowed to sell oil, and the money from that goes directly into an account that's overseen by the UN. It's an account of the Bank of Paris in a New York City office, and the UN oversees the whole thing. And there's a subgroup in the UN called the 661 Committee, which reviews products that Iraq applies to purchase to determine whether or not they think that the product could be used in whole or in part as a weapon. So one of the products that has come up, at least in terms of a controversy, the UN has denied, or at least denied that when we were talking to them in 2000 about the issue, they denied that blood bags were actually being held out of the country. Doctors in Iraq say it is because of the 661 Committee that this has been happening from time to time. At any rate, in the interview that you're talking about, the doctor had to choose because there was such a short supply of blood transfusion bags that, you know, he had to go and get B positive and had to give the transfusion to either this woman who was delivering a baby and who was hemorrhaging, mm-hmm. or to another child who was in the hospital. And he wound up making the choice that he would save the mother and the newborn. Yet, you know, this kind of thing happened frequently, and it's because of the alleged concern that, for example, the blood bag, you know, this in the anticoagulant that's in a blood transfusion bag, there's a chemical which supposedly could be extracted and turned into a chemical weapon. Right. Now, that's the kind of paranoia that is at work here and that has kept things out of the country. Right now, there are over $5.2 billion in humanitarian aid contracts that are on hold, products that could be used to save lives, but they're on hold because primarily the United States, through its vote on the Security Council, has kept those products out of the country.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, I do remember in the movie they said that 1.5 million people have died.
Right. That's based on UNICEF figures and also the figure that they still stand by, which still exists. If anything, it's greater than this, but there's a fairly famous figure that 5,000 children ages 5 and under die every month as a direct result of the sanctions. Based on the UNICEF figures that have come out in the last maybe 6 months to a year, I'd say that's actually increased to maybe more like 6,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tom, tell us how you came to actually be making this movie and what you actually hope. What were your hopes when you were making it? What did you think about when you said you wanted to make this movie? Who did you think your audience was going to be? And what were the gains that you wanted at the end?
Right. Well, I started doing this work really on a more serious basis about 4.5 years ago. But prior to that, I had been against the Gulf War when it happened. Despite the many, many excuses or reasons that we heard from the senior Bush administration at the time, I really felt like the real reason for the Gulf War was control over oil reserves. I mean, Iraq sits on the second largest oil reserve in the world. So it just seemed to me that was the actual purpose. And to tell you the truth, I haven't heard or seen anything since then to make me change my mind. If anything, I would say I've heard and seen things to sort of reinforce that belief. But like most people, when the Gulf War was over, I thought that was it. You know, that's the end of the war. But as it turns out, a few years go by and some people started to realize that the Gulf War never ended for Iraqi civilians. It ended for Saddam Hussein and his regime. You know, they're doing quite well. But for the other 23 million Iraqis, the war has never ended. They're still dying at this alarming rate, like you said just a minute ago, 1.5 million people. I mean, the biggest weapon of mass destruction to land in the last 12 years is the sanctions against Iraq.
Now, Tom, sorry to interrupt you, but for me, that makes what it says to me is that the United States is basically trying to keep the population down so that they don't build another army. I mean, that may just make sense that they don't, you know, regain strength and energy to try something or just to defend themselves.
Well, it certainly is the argument that some people within the anti-sanctions community subscribe to, and I'd have to say I do myself, that it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense that the United States government, on one hand, has said for 12 years, we've got to get Saddam and we've got to get rid of Saddam, And yet, at the same time, they implement this program that weakens the population in many different ways, including just the subsistence food rations that they get.
Everyday life.
It has destroyed the hospitals, destroyed infrastructure, not allowed them to be rebuilt. We control two-thirds of the airspace through the no-fly zones. So, and at the same time, we also knew from back in the Iran-Iraq war during the 1980s that the fact is the Hussein regime wasn't really going to put their people first. I mean, they sent hundreds of thousands of people off to die in the Iran-Iraq war, which was a war that everybody said neither side was going to win. And yet he just kept sending them and sending them and sending them. So it should come as no surprise to the U.S. government that he would also stand by while people, you know, ordinary people in Iraq were dying under the sanctions. So I really think that it's arguable that the conditions that were created were actually more about stability and total control over the second largest oil reserve in the world, as opposed to the allegations that we, you know, supposedly wanted to get rid of the Hussein regime. Just getting back to what I wanted to try to do with Greetings from Missile Street. The whole plan, you know, once I found out what was really going on in Iraq, and after going there for the first time and seeing these conditions firsthand, at that point I had been doing anti-sanctions work and learning about the whole situation for a couple of years, but actually seeing it is just a whole different experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just literally changed my life. So at the time I was working in a high-tech firm nearby in North Andover, Mass., and I went back to work, and I was just kind of staring at my computer screen and remembering all these things that I had seen. And I said, you know, I've got to do this. I've got to make this documentary, and I've got to show as many people as possible to let them know what's really going on there. So I gave notice, and for the past 2 years I've been doing this work full-time. We completed Greetings a little more than a year ago. It was early May of 2001. But the idea was to show it to anybody and everybody, and particularly in this country, that I possibly could, because I want to keep believing what the Iraqi citizens said to us. I had so many people say to us in Basra, we don't blame the American people for what's happening here, because we believe that if they knew what was happening here and the reasons why it's happening, that they would not want it to continue. And, you know, I really do want to believe that. There are times when this work becomes frustrating, and it's maybe not as easy to believe that. But, you know, deep in my heart, I believe that most Americans are good people, and that if they really knew, if they had a way of finding out the information that has been excluded from mainstream media, which most people really rely on, I think that they would really demand an end to this whole system, because as a number of prominent people who talk about this have said, this is a genocidal policy. It really is. It's just destroyed life for ordinary Iraqis, and I don't see any end in sight at this point.
Tell us about the group that you went with, Tom. Voices in the Wilderness, how you connected with them, and you went with them. There was a couple of people in the movie. I think there was four: Kathy Kelly, Lauren Gannon, Lisa Gizzi, Mark McGuire.
That's right.
Who were in your movie? Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. Well, first of all, Voices in the Wilderness was a group that early on in the mid-90s or so did start to discover what was really happening in Iraq and, you know, what was happening to the Iraqi people. And at that point, they sort of devised their plan for trying to do something about it. Essentially, it's a twofold approach. They are strictly a campaign to stop the economic sanctions against Iraq. And the way that they go about doing that is they go to Iraq without getting State Department permission, so that the act of going is a crime. It's an act of civil disobedience. And then they, when they return, they do further measures to try to bring attention to the issue. And they do that by, you know, whatever means they can to get the word out to the people in this country. Whether it's, you know, doing talks or slideshows or, in my case, doing a video. And So the individuals who are part of Voices in the Wilderness who are in Greetings from Missile Street, Kathy Kelly has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize twice for her work in trying to bring attention to the devastation that's been caused by the sanctions. Lisa, Lauren, and Mark are all still very active in anti-sanctions work. All four of them have been back to Iraq at least once since the delegation that was filmed for Greetings from Missile Street. Mm-hmm. They're all just very dedicated people.
Mm-hmm. One thing that stuck out in my mind was when I think it was Kathy Kelly was saying this. She said it was a starvation of the minds. The role not only in the healthcare, how it's affecting healthcare and nutrition and basic food, but also in education. They were talking in the movie about how everything's been affected there too. The books were the nothing more recent than 1989 were the books. You want to talk a little bit about that? Because they show you in this movie one of the schools, they're cleaning out one of the schools, but they have no cleaning supplies to clean it, so they just
That's
use
right.
water and a broom.
Yeah, it just shows the many ways in which the whole sanctions regime has affected their society, really to its core. As far as education goes, I think the figure is actually now over 25% of school-aged children in Iraq are out of school for one reason or another. You know, maybe they're trying to find some kind of work to supplement their family's income, or in many cases, if a family has more than one child, because there are now costs related to education in Iraq, which there wasn't before.
It used to be universal, right?
That's right. Healthcare and education were free. Now there are a number of costs attached to the whole thing. So basically, you know, if you've got a family of three children in Iraq and you're an average citizen, which, the underclass there constitutes a tremendous percentage of Iraqi society. So if you're part of that, and you've got a few kids, chances are you're probably going to be able to only send one child to school because you've got to pay the cost of getting them clothes and maybe
shoes.
A backpack or something like
shoes
that and shoes.
And, backpacks, yeah.
And those costs haven't changed. So the way the economy has been affected that also affects these children and their lives is you've got these products that, the price of which hasn't really changed. So, for example, a pair of shoes costs about 5,500 dinar. That isn't really a lot of money to you or me. It's only a couple of bucks, literally. But to the average person in Iraq, that's a month's salary. So imagine if you had to spend an entire month's salary to buy a new pair of shoes for your child. That's what these people are facing.
That's really incredible. That's incredible. Tom, tell us, you were there during, I noticed in the movie it said, the hottest, you purposely went during the hottest time of the year. And
yeah.
The temperature was between 120 and 130 degrees. Tell us what it was like living under that kind of, I can't even imagine that kind of heat. Tell us about the conditions too. I mean, they talk about the raw sewage in the streets and about the trash and the water, even getting
kids
water.
Kids running through the raw sewage.
And with no shoes on. Tell us what it was like.
Yeah. Well, first of all, part of the Voices campaign or idea was to make this project they didn't go out of their way to make it as comfortable as possible. They chose the hottest months. They wanted to see, what is life like at its worst when you're there in Iraq and living among the ordinary people. Gandhian concept of trying to get an idea of what life is like for these people.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first day and night that I was there particularly. You know, I was living in New Hampshire at the time, and it happened to be a very, very cool and wet summer prior to my arrival in Iraq. And I had been hoping that it would be nice and hot and humid, but no such luck.
To get you ready.
So I get there, and it is approaching 130 degrees. There's actually a photograph that was taken by Alan Pogue, who's a pretty well-known photographer who's been all around the world the last 25 years, right. And he's done a lot of stuff in Iraq. Mm-hmm. He's got a shot of me sweating, and my shirt is drenched, and I'm sitting there writing in a notebook, and it's 128 degrees. That was the first day. He and I really thought that we were in serious trouble from being run around in the heat on that first day that we were there. Because the other delegation members had been there for a couple of weeks, so they knew their way around, and they had all these ideas for, you know, we've got to take you here so you can film. We've got to take Alan here so you can take photos. They're literally running us around in the noonday sun, you know, 12, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And there was a point where Alan and I were just sitting there, and this little boy came up with a little saucer with some water in it, and we poured it over our heads and thanked him profusely. We went back to our host's home, and he and I just sort of draped ourselves on the floor and just laid there. And,
a nice, cool floor.
Yeah, it was just incredible. And the first night that I was there, the heat never broke. Basically, it stayed very, very hot all night long and very humid. And it was the most uncomfortable I've ever been at night.
And no air conditioning.
We were up on the roof of the house where we stayed.
They're sleeping on the roofs, yeah.
And yet it was still just unbearable. And I am lying there thinking, what am I doing here?
Why am I here?
I see dehydration was a problem. How did you work with how did you work around all of the water problems you were having there?
Mm. Yeah, that was the one way in which we deviated from, part of the plan was to eat proportionate amounts of the same foods that they were eating there in Iraq on the rations. So we were, eating lentils and rice that we would buy at the market. Mm-hmm. The one way that we went away from that was we did buy bottled water, which is in pretty short supply.
To stay healthy so you can
otherwise you might get sick. They might be immune to certain things, but you wouldn't be.
That's right.
With the water,
so you could buy water there. You couldn't use pills or something, those.
Some people have considered trying stuff like that, but it just I don't think that there's enough consensus that it would be completely effective. Mm. So most people aren't willing to take that kind of a risk, and I definitely wasn't. But the water is, like I said, it's in very short supply. When we went one of the times to get some water at a market down the street from where we were, they literally had just gotten a shipment. There was a gentleman taking off with about a third of it in his car who had just, bought a third of the shipment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We bought about another third of it. And then literally as we're loading it into the car, the taxi that brought us over, another person is pulling up and buying the rest of it. So literally in a matter of minutes, it was all gone.
Right, right.
And I figured out at one point the bottled water that I drank in about a day and a half was equal to the average 1 month salary for Iraqis. So there's no way that they could possibly afford.
They can't afford that.
To be drinking bottled water. But yeah, like you said, it was a matter of feeling as though we had to do that. Yeah. Otherwise, if we drank the bad water, it would be a matter of a day or two.
Right.
Yeah, we'd either be, deathly ill there or have to be immediately flown back to someplace where we could be treated.
There'd be no documentary.
That's right.
In the movie, there was mention of one family where the father got water from where he worked. You could see, you saw him going out the door with some kind of bucket to get.
Right.
And they said something about water being treated by reverse osmosis. He was going to get water from work and was bringing it home.
That's right.
To use to cook in. So, yeah. But is that cost or was that for free because he worked there?
I think that in his case, yeah, that he was able to get a certain amount of that for free because he worked there.
Because of his work,
But there was another family that's shown in the documentary where Lisa Gizzi is talking about a family that she spent a lot of time with, and they simply can't afford reverse osmosis water. So
That's what I was wondering about was the cost.
Yeah, they have to, if they're going to drink water, they boil it for 20 minutes or more. And then obviously, try to find a way to cool it down for a while.
Now, you live with one of these families as well, with the people from Voices in the World.
That's right.
You live there.
Yeah. Because I came along later on, and because I'm a single guy, there was a little bit of difficulty in terms of placing me, because obviously in southern Iraq there's a pretty substantial Shiite population, and they're fairly devout in terms of they don't want a situation where I would be living with a single woman, and they also don't particularly want a situation where I would be living with a family that has a father who goes out to work for X number of hours per day, just because I'd be, a man there with this person's wife. And they weren't comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. So as it turned out, I wound up staying in the home where Kathy Kelly and Lauren Cannon already were staying.
Okay.
That made it a little bit more sort of comfortable. Although it was a single woman who ran this household.
Okay.
And it actually worked out quite well, because I, from that home, it was a sort of, home base, and I could go out to the other delegates' homes, mm-hmm. or go out in the streets and film and talk to people and so on.
Mm-hmm. How long were you there, Tom?
On that particular delegation, I was there for approximately 6 weeks, and I had been there for a couple of weeks prior to that in early 2000, so total of a couple of months. Mm-hmm.
So what, did you have a problem when you were there? Like, did people sort of give you tough times? I know there was a problem about going, they said they might arrest you or something, the states, for going there, you're on your own, or can you kind of talk
right,
about that?
Right, right. Well, yeah, there are potential penalties for going.
They would never bring them up, I don't think, right?
Well, actually, that was, there was not all that much concern that it would necessarily come up until the Bush administration came into power, and they, from the beginning, started to threaten sort of verbally and through the media that they were going to crack down on delegations. Many, many delegations have gone since that time, but just in the last few days, I've learned that one person in Seattle, who's done a lot of work for Voices in the Wilderness, is being fined $10,000 because he's brought or allegedly has brought medical products to Iraq in the past. Mm-hmm. So I don't know exactly where that stands at this point. But
so you have potentially of going to jail and being fined for going. So you took a risk.
Yeah, actually, the potentials are as high as I think the maximum is 12 years in jail and $1 million in fines. So there definitely is that potential. But in terms of the way Iraqis acted towards us, I was just amazed at their hospitality and graciousness and generosity. And these are people who have virtually nothing. I mean, but they were always so anxious to invite us in and, have some tea or anything that they had to offer, if they had anything. Mm-hmm. And I really expected there to be some kind of backlash, but it was amazing the tiny, tiny percentage of people who seemed to just immediately, take a dislike to me or anybody else on the delegation, because we were obviously, not from there.
Yeah.
And yet those same people... It would just be a matter of smiling and talking to them, wishing them peace, and so on. Most of them right away would just open up and warm up. Maybe one or two still sort of harbored a sort of defensiveness. And yet I spent a good amount of time talking to one of those people, and he never came across as really hostile. After 12 years of sanctions and no-fly zone bombings and so on, and the devastation that has been rained down upon their society, it's understandable that some people would be skeptical that even, well-meaning folks who are there trying to help are going to really make any difference.
Right.
But we have to believe that we're going to be able to, and we have to keep on.
That's great.
Oh, Tom, I can't believe we're running out of time for what this always happened.
I just wanted to say, Jim has watched this movie.
Jim's actually seen the movie,
so
too.
So that's great. So your movie is getting around.
Yeah.
It is, actually, and there's a chance it might be getting around a little bit more in the near future. I'm trying to get it on to different stations and programs, and it actually was carried on Free Speech TV, which is a satellite station out of Colorado.
And we can put it on LTC here, Low Telecommunications. It's pretty big.
Sounds good.
Yeah. I didn't even get the chance to ask you some other things, like about the funding. I know you told me earlier about the funding.
I think we got a few minutes.
Funding.
Right, you can stay longer if I can just say you're listening to Thinking Out Loud on WJUL Lowell.
All right, great.
So, do you want to just mention some of your funders that helped you with this, with making this movie, with this project, and getting this to fruition?
Yep. Well, a lot of it has been out of pocket from my own savings, which no longer exist.
Well, worth the cost, though.
Definitely. I think the price is worth it. In addition to that, Voices helped out to a certain extent. My Quaker meeting, which is in Dover, New Hampshire, has helped out. Mm-hmm. I've gotten one or two small grants from a couple of different private foundations, and those were primarily used more to just sort of survive over, you know, the last couple of years that I've been doing this full time.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, yeah, it was out of my own pocket and with Voice's help that I was able to pay the biggest expense involved, which was the editing cost.
That's great. Anything else, Julie?
I think that's about it, Tony. Right. We're going to wrap up the show for today.
Talk about Solarfest a little bit.
Oh, just a little.
Yeah, I wanted to invite people to Solarfest in Vermont. It's the weekend of July 13th. Julie and I are going. I think Tom might join us. It's a weekend where everything's run off solar power. There's great jazz, blues, all kinds of wonderful workshops on solar energy, photovoltaics, all kinds of activities. So we welcome you to join us, and maybe we'll see you all up there. And thank you for having us today, Jim, at WJUL Lowell, Thinking Out Loud, the Environmental Corner. And Tom, thanks for coming down.
Thanks a lot for having me.
If people wanted to order or borrow a copy of the video, where could they go, or who could they contact?
They should maybe contact me, and then I can get
Tom.
Me. Yeah.
You give your
address? So that's Julie_Villareal, VillareAl at UML.edu, or 978-934-4772, and I can put you in touch with Tom. And we can get you a copy of the video, or you can find out more from us.
And Tom, thanks for coming down. And now we're going to go get some food.
All right. Sounds good. Great. Thanks a lot.
Check in with us next week. Thank you.